Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
When I was little, I was really crazy about books about illnesses, you know, images of like skin rashes and things like that.
Meet Agnes Bodor, Hungarian transplant and neuroanatomist at the Allen Brain Institute in Seattle. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Sound Effect.
We had a very good family friend, and he took us to buy ice cream. And next to the ice cream shop, there was an optics store. And there was a little microscope. And I just knew I wanted that microscope. And I told him I wanted that microscope. But we were really poor. It was the communist dictatorship. Like, there was barely anything. The biggest store was big as a 7-Eleven, probably. And before Christmas, we were at home with my sister. And this family friend knocked on the door, and oh, we were so happy seeing him. And he said, I just want to leave this here, give it to your father. And he left the packet, so I got it for Christmas. And then I was putting everything into that microscope, like little fingernail pieces and things like anything you can find. If somebody cut the finger accidentally, I run for a piece of blood, like a drop of blood. I was like completely crazy for it. I loved it, yes.
These days, Agnes has traded her kitty microscope for a half dozen hulking transmission electron microscopes. She's mapping the neurons in these tiny slices of mouse brain, about 2,500 times thinner than a sheet of paper. That requires some special tools.
You cut the slice, you take a little metal plate, which is also similarly tiny. Other hand hold a stick with an eyelash on it, glued together.
Wait, an actual eyelash?
An actual eyelash, actually, yes.
And human eyelash?
Yeah. Some people prefer pig eyelash. You use this eyelash to make the section float on that little membrane, and then you fish it out.
Brain science has always been a passion of Agnes's, but these days she has another preoccupation.
I really love cats. Their body is just beautiful. How they move or everything is beautiful.
Agnes doesn't just admire cats. She paints them. She's a respected cat artist.
I like this one very much. It's a tuxedo cat. I painted not a long time ago.
She works in watercolors. The cat's bodies are fuzzed out and languid, culminating in these sharp, expressive little feline faces. Agnes says the act of painting and the act of picking out neural networks from a jumble of cells both involve letting her mind do its thing without directing it too much.
You cannot really think about it, because if you think, you definitely screw it up. You can't think.
Agnes has managed to juggle both of her pursuits so far, but she dreams of turning to just one of them full time. She even set up a GoFundMe page to raise money for a new lifestyle.
I wanted to go down to the desert for like at least 6 months and just paint. But I completely gave up on that because nothing happened.
If you could, would you leave your neuroscience work and go do art?
Currently, yes.
This week on Sound Effect, our theme is I'm into it. Whether it's cat art or accordions or jello wrestling, it's stories of people with very particular passions. The Seattle band Culture Shock lives up to its name. They weave together Eastern European folk music with strains of metal and so-called gypsy punk. The new song Taiyu is sung all in Japanese. Culture Shock Culture Shock's songs promote justice and rail against fascism. Lead singer Gino Yevjevic is a burly, tattooed fellow with a shaved head, beard down to his chest, and streaked with gray. Gino's passion for art, his compulsion to create, is what eventually pulled him out of the war zone his hometown of Sarajevo had become. In 1992, Yugoslavia was busy tearing itself to pieces. The country was breaking up along religious lines, leading to a long and bloody war. But before everything descended into chaos, Gino was living the dream. He was a clean-shaven, suit-and-tie-wearing, ponytail-sporting pop star. The name of his group, Gino Banana.
Gino Banana.
We became pretty recognized. I hate the word famous and celebrity, so I don't even know how to say that. Yeah, we were like, whatever.
Did you get recognized in the street?
Yeah.
Did you sign autographs?
Yeah.
Did people want to pose for pictures with you?
Yeah. No, there was no selfies, though. Selfies did not exist. It was great. And you know what? I have to say, like, people, oh, it's horrible burden. No, it wasn't. It was great. I loved it. Especially when you're a kid. It's amazing. And, you know, but then you overgrow it. Then you overgrow it. And then maybe something like war happens to, you know, to remind you, hey. You know, I don't know what would have happened. I mean, I probably would become one of those guys at the record label, you know.
If not for the war, you mean?
If not for the war, right. You know, I envy you, actually. You guys go to war and you come back from the war. We don't go to war. War comes to us. Sitting home, minding your own business, psh, boom.
For more than 2 months now, Sarajevo has been under siege.
Then we were trapped in the city. It's amazing. So we were in war, and you all of a sudden you can't get out, and you have a bunch of record-selling musicians in the town doing nothing.
So once the reality kind of set in of being locked down where you were, of the war being, you know, surrounding mm-hmm. Sarajevo, how did you cope? Like, where did you direct your energies?
I actually recommended my friends and these directors and choreographers and a bunch of actors. We were all in one theater, and I gave an idea to do musical Hair. I remember everybody saying, are you crazy, man? Anti-war musical in a war-torn country? Like, yeah, but let's twist it out. Who cares? Let's play for ourselves. We did whole musical.
Was it one performance or a series of them?
It was about 300 performances.
Oh my gosh. So were you doing it like every day?
Every single day. At 1 o'clock p.m. because we had a curfew at 9.
And did people show up?
Packed every single time. We never had one place. And we ran it for 3 years. We got devastated. Our sound guy died like first year. My guitar player and co-writer, he got injured by going to the theater. He's alive still. People took out of shrapnel out of his head. We redid the play again and running it until the point where we couldn't do it anymore.
Why was it worth risking your life to go make that show?
Selfishness is allowed in art. Art might be one and only activity of a human that can allow selfishness as a positive category. That means that you're creating what comes to you, that the creation is a purpose to itself. That's, I think, what was driving us.
At the performances, UN officials and American celebrities sat shoulder to shoulder with the trapped residents of Sarajevo. The production also happened to catch the attention of Phil Alden Robinson, the man who wrote and directed the movie Field of Dreams. What had seemed like an insane idea just a few years before, putting on an anti-war musical in a war zone, ended up being Gino's ticket out of Sarajevo. Phil Alden Robinson got visas for Gino and some of the other cast members of Hair and brought them to the United States. He wanted to make a movie about this unlikely theater troupe.
Phil could not put the movie together because probably it wasn't very attractive to, I guess, you know, it wasn't very attractive to Hollywood. There was no Steven Seagal saving Blonde from the barbarians, you know, that don't know anything else but fighting each other. You know, we were portrayed like a people, which, you know, it's not sellable, I guess. And that kind of confirmed my stand about alternative music and alternative art and never to go to the commercial world again. And then, you know, the only thing that we did, we came to Seattle and made the theater about the theater play. That was, you know, the second prize.
And so you created the play Behind God's Back, yeah, which was a play about the production of Hair. And what was that like to do? Was it...
It was great.
Was it weird?
It was weird. It was weird. I constantly had a feeling of underperforming, not in a way of performance, but on a way of like I am. Very important for me was not to use my experience and that of many of my friends for my own gain. And in that moment, there were so many movies. Welcome to Sarajevo. Christmas in Sarajevo. What Christmas, man? You know, it's just like everybody's using Sarajevo left and right. And I didn't even want to use it in my songs. Didn't even want to use it in my theater play. If anybody should use it for the game, people of Sarajevo should use it for the game, not people over here, right? I felt it would be a betrayal of my friends.
When Behind God's Back wrapped up, Gino stayed in Seattle, he got a permanent green card, and he kept creating. In 1996, Gino formed Culture Shock. The band's still going strong with a devoted following in Europe. And then at some point, Gino found himself in a new kind of creative project as well. He writes plays, and he helps a specific population put on their own shows, people with developmental disabilities. Right now, they're working on A Midsummer Night's Dream.
It's time for me to do something for somebody else.
Do you get a different kind of gratification from that? Like, do you get a different satisfaction from that type of work than you did when you were center stage?
Yeah. I like supporting people in their achievements. I love it. I think that's what I was missing in my life. I'm finding it right now. Because it's beautiful when you see somebody achieve something, and you know that you support that. It's not about you. Art therapy and whatever, however we call it, is something that just crowned my life.
Gino Yevgevic, playwright, counselor to special needs adults, and lead singer of Culture Shock. To see a video of the band's new song, Tie You, head over to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and today's theme is I'm Into It, stories of unusual hobbies, passions, and obsessions. Now we're about to get a peek into a secret society. It's a little bit like Fight Club, but with Jell-O. Sound Effect's Bethany Denton takes us along for the ride.
It's a Saturday night in Seattle. I'm in South Lake Union, walking toward what I'm told is one of the most unique live productions in the city. Along the way, I pass two metal shows and twice as many bars before I reach my destination, a boxing gym. The venue is Evolve Fitness. The show is Jello Underground, an all-female Jello wrestling production. Part performance, part competition, part declaration of female power and sex positivity.
And of course guys come and they love it and all that kind of stuff, but this is our thing. We are choosing. No one is forcing us. We are choosing to do this. We are choosing to put on this show. And that's where the power lies.
Normally, Evolve is a kickboxing and wrestling gym, but tonight, Evolve's wrestling ring becomes a stage, covered with plastic tarp. A large inflatable kiddie pool sits in the middle, filled with green Jell-O. Okay, it's not exactly Jell-O. It's more like aloe vera mixed with gelatin and probably some green food dye. It's not nearly as sticky as the real stuff. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Here's the show's producer, Gracie Garnet.
We started out as a burlesque troupe, but we were like, we gotta do something else, but what is that gonna look like?
Gracie tells me that she felt burnt out by all the hustle it takes to choreograph, produce, and run a burlesque show. She and a few other members of her troupe had the idea to try something new instead, something they hadn't seen before in Seattle. One thing led to another, and Jell-O Underground was born.
We had no idea what we were doing the first show. Oh my gosh, we were at the Jewel Box on their wood stage, put a pool out there, not thinking about, maybe we should have some padding underneath the pool, you know? So there was a couple, like, girls saying ouch and whatnot. No major injuries, thankfully. And then through there, we kind of moved up because our crowds kept expanding.
Gracie and her troupe were on to something. They soon started selling out at their old burlesque venue, the Jewel Box. They tried a few sports bars and eventually connected with Evolve Fitness, a perfect match with their real-life wrestling ring. They've been performing there monthly-ish since 2009. Now, since I'm a lady with the microphone, they let me back into the green room to interview some of the wrestlers.
I mean, most girls are afraid to wrestle me, but I look forward to
backstage, I see all kinds of women. Thin women in lingerie, athletic women in sports bras and biking shorts, big women in cutoffs and tank tops. Some of them have rainbow colors in their hair and big fake eyelashes. Some have tattoos and hairy armpits. They're all applying makeup or sticking pasties onto their nipples or stretching with each other. They take turns deciding how they want their matches to go. Playful or scrappy? Sexy or athletic? Jell-O Underground is open to any woman who wants to wrestle on that stage. Honestly, even if it's the night of the performance, they'll make room for you in the bracket. Reigning champion G.I. Jen is one of the more scrappy, competitive wrestlers. She tells me that she always aims to win, but that's not what keeps her coming back.
It's always fun to wrestle, and I never come in nervous because whether I win or lose, like, I'm going to have a good time. So I'm just really happy to be here. I love these girls. I see them once when we do this, and then it's like a family when we come together.
Who are our religions?
Huh?
1, 2, 3, 4. You guys especially need to listen. So
there aren't a lot of rules to Jell-O wrestling. The main ones have to do with safety. No standing in the pool because it's so slippery, no closed fists, mind your piercings, no exposed nipples, although that last one is less to do with safety and more to do with Seattle's municipal code.
1, 2, 3, Jell-O!
But as for the rules of engagement, there's not a lot to it. I watch match after match as the wrestlers roll around in the pool together like slippery otters. There aren't any points to earn or ways to pin an opponent. In fact, the winner is determined by the audience, so it's more about presentation and personality. Sometimes the audience likes a jokester making big expressive faces. Sometimes the audience roots for the shy underdog. And sometimes it's impossible to tell who won without having the audience cheer 2 or 3 times. Something's been on my mind since I got here. So I take the opportunity to ask the show's MC, Punches.
Why Jell-O?
It's kind of like that whole movement of women taking back the C word. Like, that is used in such a derogatory form. And it's like, no, that's my word. Like, don't take my power away from me. You know, Jell-O wrestling, mud wrestling, it's always been geared toward, like, sleazy guys. So this is our thing. If I want to get in the pool, it's because I want to have fun wrestling that other woman.
What would you say to someone who sees JLO wrestling, just period in general, saw this tonight and thought that's misogynistic, that's exploitative? What would you say to that?
I would just tell them to F off. I've done it before. I've had lots of conversations, you know, family members and stuff. Most of my family's really supportive of it. You know, I got some outliers. You know, they look at my mom. How could you let your daughter do that? How could you let your daughter put herself on display? And she's like, because I raised her to be her own woman. I raised her to not let anyone tell her. You know, it's fun to be sexy. And if there's women out there who don't find this fun, more power to them. It doesn't, everyone's version of sexy is different. Like, everyone's version of normal is different. You can't pin it down to one Webster dictionary definition.
For a few of the wrestlers, they don't often get to feel sexy and badass and powerful outside of the ring. Here's one wrestler, Arcanum.
Technically, I'm the first trans girl that got invited to compete here. And the first time I got up there, they got loud the moment they heard my name. And to be honest, the moment they heard that I was trans, they got louder. And it was amazing. The biggest confidence boost I've ever had.
Here's one more wrestler, Stunt Puppy.
I have a lot of trouble kind of like being sure of myself as who I am. So like once I got in the pool, it kind of just like all seems natural. And it was just like really good fun and like brought me back to wrestling when I was a kid. And I hadn't felt that in a long time.
Tonight there are about 100 people in the audience, a pretty even split of women and men, it seems. Now and then a wrestler will slip through the crowd, easy to spot in her costume and makeup. After all, she has to schmooze if she wants to win over the audience to win a match. I'm the kind of person who's pretty vigilant keeping an eye out for other women when I'm out at bars or shows. I do this because I've seen women being groped, harassed, and followed, and I've even intervened at times.
All the girls know, no matter where they roam in here, one of us has an eye on them. They can, I always tell them, if someone gets grabby at you or someone says something negative, come find me. I will take care of them. Because I don't play that game. And I'm 5'3", but I'm not afraid of anyone. And I always tell people I've never cut anyone on accident.
If I had to guess, and if I'm being honest, I'm sure there are still some sleazy guys in the audience tonight. I think that's probably inevitable with this kind of show, which is why you won't find me in that JLO wrestling ring. But I do believe Punches and Gracie Garnet and the rest of JLO Underground when they say that's not the point. They're not doing it for those guys. I look around and realize how apparent it is that JLO Underground is completely female operated. Women are manning the door, taking tickets, bartending, doing coat check, emceeing, refereeing. Even if wrestling around in a kiddie pool of fake JLO before a crowd isn't exactly my kind of feminism, I do see why the wrestlers feel so safe and confident.
That story from Sound Effects, Bethany Denton.
Oh, and in case you were wondering, yes, there are JLO shots.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is I'm Into It. Craig Egan, who lives in Tacoma, stumbled onto his obsession kind of by accident. It happened on Facebook.
A friend of mine posted some graph that kind of had an anti-vax slant to it. And at that point, I had no idea that this was even a thing.
Anti-vax, as in people who believe that vaccinations are harmful and oppose giving them to kids.
I figured kind of, theoretically, there's probably people out there who didn't vaccinate, just like there's people who don't believe in any sort of medical interventions. I kind of put them in the same category as people who don't believe in dinosaurs. And so I followed the link. I followed to the page that she had posted it from. And it was this page called Proud Parents of Unvaccinated Children. And I was like, wow, there's 20,000 people who don't believe in vaccines. And so I went onto the page. And I was actually very polite. And I said, hey, I don't agree with this, but can we have a conversation? I asked a few questions. And I immediately was banned from the page. And I was like, well, you can't do that. And it started a grudge. It started a grudge with me.
Did you find it productive arguing with people online?
No. So my golden rule for arguing online has always been to argue for the observer. If I'm arguing with somebody who is dead set anti-vax and there's absolutely no way I'm going to change their mind, and I understand that and I accept that. But if I can break down their arguments and show how crazy they are, there's 100 people watching the conversation who are maybe on the fence who look at this and say, okay, this guy's making a lot of sense. This person isn't making a lot of sense.
Over the last few years, Craig has continued to show up in anti-vaccination forums, and the people he's needling have retaliated. They've complained of harassment to the FBI and have published Craig's personal information online.
I've had my home address and where I work and things like that published so many times that it's become just an empty threat. It's like, hey, you want to show up for coffee, show up. But if you just want to keep publishing my home address, it's not going to faze me anymore.
In your heart of hearts, what bugs you so much about this?
At the base of it, they're putting children in danger. And that's really the fundamental issue here. If somebody believes that the moon landing was faked, or they believe that the CIA killed Kennedy, or any conspiracy theory like that, you can make the argument that they believe that, but who are they really hurting, right? But these people are hurting people. Andrew Wakefield, who is the former doctor who really started this idea that vaccines cause autism, he literally started a measles outbreak in Minnesota, where there was a Somali community who had an uptick in autism diagnoses. And he went there, convinced them that vaccines were causing autism. They stopped vaccinating their kids. And literally, like within 2 years, there was a measles outbreak with children in the hospital.
By the way, Andrew Wakefield is the man most identified with the discredited idea that vaccines cause autism. He was later exposed for committing fraud in his studies and had his medical license stripped. More on him in a bit. Anyway, last summer, something happened that jolted Craig Egan's online activism into real life. There was a new movie playing in Tacoma in the neighborhood theater just about 6 blocks from Craig's home.
In 1978, the prevalence of autism was about 1 in 15,000 children.
If we assume that things are going to continue as they have, we can predict that by 2032, 80% of the boys born will end up on the autism spectrum.
It was a documentary called Vaxxed, From Cover-Up to Catastrophe. The film's director is Andrew Wakefield. It continues to promote his debunked claims about young children getting autism from vaccines. Craig headed to the theater to protest in person.
Of course, I'm like, well, I'll put together a cheap homemade drawn sign that says "Vaccine Save Lives." Go down there and just stand there. I wasn't confrontational. I just stood there with my sign, and just in case anybody, I didn't want to argue with them, but I wanted to be the first person somebody talked to if they wandered up and said, "Hey, what's this all about?" And so I did that, went down there, and the first person who greeted me was actually a news reporter from a local news station. And so then I got on the news, and I thought, well, that was easy. So maybe I should go to their next stop. And so I looked up their schedule and decided, okay, I can make this stop. And then just kind of as a joke offhand, I said, hey, wouldn't it be funny if I followed them around like the Grateful Dead for the summer and just went to every stop they made to. So I put up a GoFundMe to get me to the next few stops, were like in Idaho and Montana. And I figured that would be it. But the GoFundMe just took off, and it was $2,000, $4,000, $6,000, $10,000. It started just growing and growing and growing. And I ended up on the road for a good month and a half, maybe, from here to Philadelphia.
So wait, this means that you were in town after town, showing up at their events?
Yes.
Dogging their steps?
Uh-huh. Yeah, with a simple sign that said "Vaccines Save Lives." When they went to Minneapolis, Minnesota, they did have it at a public park, but they kept it invite only, if you will. They kept the location secret and only to people that they knew they could trust to come there. But they were also accepting new stories for vaccine injuries. So my girlfriend messaged one of the producers under a false name and described a vaccine injury that she had had with the Gardasil vaccine to protect against HPV. And the story that she gave described getting the vaccine at 14 and then going through puberty. Basically, she said, oh, yeah, I gained weight. I had menstrual issues. I had acne. And she just described all the conditions of puberty that any normal 14-year-old kid is going to go through. And, of course, they were like, oh, that sounds like a vaccine injury. We would love you to come be on the bus, tell your story. Here's the location. Don't tell Craig Egan where we're going to be. And they, like,
Did they mention to be my name? They named you.
Yeah, they mentioned me by name and was like, don't let anybody out because we don't want Craig to show up.
So having spent so much time with these folks, you must have, like, in certain ways gotten to know them.
Yes.
What did you learn about these people that you were arguing against and what surprised you most?
So following the vaxxed bus around, what they would do is they would bring these parents and these children onto this bus, put a camera in front of them, and they would have these parents with their kids sitting right there say, here's my vaccinated damaged child, and here's my unvaccinated perfect child, with the kids sitting right there. And it just horrified me that you would do that to your kids. But, I mean, I would just get responses like, well, we eat organic. What else could it be? Well, what do you mean, what else could it be? That's not really an answer for pointing out a cause. And so for them, I do feel for them. It's sad that they're being exploited. It's sad that they're being misinformed. And they just want an answer. And they just want their kids to be healthy. And that's all we all want. We all want our kids to be healthy. We want our kids to be fine. And they just bought into misinformation. And I feel for them, but they're still wrong. And they're still making things worse by spreading misinformation. So it's a difficult line to walk. It really is.
So do you think you've changed anybody's minds?
I've changed a lot of minds. And it's never the person I thought it was going to be. Like I said before, when I try to argue for the observer, it's always those observers who come back and say, hey, we never argued directly, but I watched your argument here. I've watched your antics over the years, and now I'm going to vaccinate my kids, and thank you. And so I have dozens and dozens of emails and, you know, direct messages on Facebook from people who credit me with changing their mind. But like I said, it's never the person I argued with directly. The person I argued with directly is still stuck in their ways. I think when people are up there making dangerous misinformation statements, you should always confront them and correct them. I don't think you should ever let it fly. Even if it's futile in the moment, it's going to help somebody somewhere.
Craig Egan lives in Tacoma. He says he plans on making his own documentary about trolling the publicity tour for Vaxxed. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're sharing stories about people who are really captivated by something. For Jenny Schrum, the thing she's into wasn't on her radar a few years ago. She didn't even know it existed. Jenny is a national park biologist on San Juan Island. KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe introduces us to Jenny and to the tiny creatures that rely on her to survive.
Jenny Schrum works at San Juan Island National Historical Park. It offers a mix of saltwater shorelines, woodlands, and native prairie in the heart of the Salish Sea. This woman exudes energy and joy. With her quick smile and a sparkle in her eye, she has such a youthful manner you'd never guess she's in her mid-40s. But she wasn't always happy about this assignment. Standing on a sunny, windswept bluff near American Camp, she tells me she worked on seasonal contracts for nearly 20 years at national parks all over the West. As a biologist, most of those jobs involved monitoring large animals.
I've worked with lynx in Colorado and wolverine in Idaho and grizzly bears in Montana, seals in Alaska, hawksbill turtles in Hawaii. So yeah, just great experiences and fun, beautiful places.
But San Juan Island was the one place she kept coming back to. In 2014, she got orders to come to the National Historical Park to work with Youth Corps crews, young people learning how to do field work.
And then when I got here, change of plans, and I was told that I was going to be working almost exclusively with the island marble butterfly.
There are only about 200 of them left in the wild, and San Juan Island is the only place they live. They're small, and Jenny's job with them would be mostly in a ramshackle lab in the woods.
Initially, I was mad. I was like, what? But I thought I was going to be working with work crews and being outside and getting to do all this cool stuff.
It turned out they had hired two people to do the same job. This was a huge disappointment because Jenny had recently come to the conclusion that she wanted to work with people. This woman, who had spent so much of her life outside in the wild, surveying big, charismatic species like grizzly bears and lynx, would be stuck in a cabin, focusing on creatures that start out not much larger than the head of a pin. She'd have to become a kind of nanny to island marble eggs and caterpillars to keep the species from going extinct. On top of everything else, the work itself was intimidating.
I had done a couple of butterfly surveys in the past, but yeah, when I found out I was going to be the butterfly specialist, I was like, oh dear God. They don't know what they're in for.
Jenny brings tiny eggs and caterpillars into the lab on cuttings of mustard plants from the park's prairies and beaches. They're kept in soft mesh cages that look like portable laundry hampers. Fresh branches are added till the caterpillars form cocoons or chrysalises. And she has to make sure that each one is placed just right on small wooden dowels that resemble shish kebab skewers.
Sometimes they'll set up their cocoons like on the side of the cage. We end up having to do a little arts and crafts where we remove them from the side of the cage, we glue them to the shish kebab skewer, and then you'll see that little red thread that's around their waist. So they usually tie themselves in with what we call a girdle strap. So if they don't have that girdle strap, we will tie the red string for them. And that kind of acts to help secure them to the post.
Otherwise, they can get stuck on the side of the cage and their wings get pulled off. And it's the wings that give the island marble butterfly its name for the camouflage pattern on the underside, which is bright green mixed with white.
Fresh spring green. And then by the time it's in its later stages, it's actually got these like rose-colored streaks and a little bit of yellow. And if you like squint just right, yeah, like a purpley blue. Yeah, it's actually quite striking. But that, you know, that's its caretakers talking, and maybe I'm not the most objective person.
The caterpillar spends as much as 10 months in its chrysalis and only about 6 days as an adult butterfly.
When you see them moving around, you're like, there is an animal with a mission. Like, they just look spazzy. Like, they're like, I got stuff to get done and I only got 6 days to do it. Get out of my way. And there's a way, like, I feel like sometimes through the spring, I'm able to harness that energy to like get through what I need to get done in a day. I just think of the island marble and I'm like, okay, here we go.
At the same time, becoming the caretaker to this critter in all of its forms has forced Jenny to slow down and become aware of a whole new world of observations in the lab. She's become fascinated with all the ways the butterfly seems perfectly adapted to the mustard plants. For example, the caterpillar's mouth develops in tandem with flower parts that it feeds on. Even though she took on this caretaker role rather reluctantly at first, she's come to love not just the rare and unique features of the island marble butterfly, but all kinds of other butterflies too.
I mean, everywhere I go, I hone in on the butterflies. I chase butterflies all over the place, you know, all the time. And I think that happens, of course, with anything that you take an interest in, is you just start noticing it everywhere. And in places where, you know, I was like, were there ever butterflies here before? Well, of course there were. And it was just, you know, we don't always notice what our world is throwing at us. And, you know, starting to think about, well, how do other insects, like they go from being a worm essentially to being this, you know, animal that can fly. You know, it's like they get to live 3 or 4 different lifetimes in one. Yeah, so it's super cool. And that was something I hadn't even really thought about before.
Now, you could easily make the argument that it's ridiculous to spend all of this time and effort on keeping just a few hundred island marble butterflies from blinking out. But Jenny thinks it's important.
I do think of them sometimes as being a key. Like, if you find a key in your house, you don't chuck that key. You don't know what it goes to, but you're not going to throw that key away, because if you find out what its purpose is 10 years from now and you realize, whoa, baby, we needed that key and now we don't, you can't just recreate it. And so you don't go tossing these things away just because you don't know what they're for. You know, I think that there's a reason that they're out here, and they're worthy of protection.
And for her, this tiny butterfly has become a kind of key, opening up new doors. Doing this work has forced her to become a better communicator with people. She's had to learn how to find the right scientists to ask them the right questions so she can keep the island marble alive. In all those years she was doing fieldwork by herself, she never did this type of networking. So in a weird way, despite her initial resistance to do this work because it involved being isolated in a lab, she's now connected to the scientific community in ways she never could have imagined. But that's what happens when you become the greatest champion for a creature that's holding on by a thread.
That story from KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe. You're listening to Sound Effect from KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is I'm Into It.
All music is three elements: melody, bass, and rhythm. So the accordion is the only musical instrument in the world that produces melody, bass, and rhythm at the same time that you can take with you.
That's Joe Petosa Jr., and to say he and his family are into accordions would not be doing them justice. The Petosa Accordion Company goes back almost 100 years when Carlo Petosa started handcrafting accordions in his Seattle basement. That tradition was passed down to Carlo's son, Joe Petosa, then to his grandson, Joe Jr., and now on to his great-grandson, Joe III. The custom instruments they make are sought after all over the world.
So on a typical full-size, you know, professional-level instrument, they range from 500 to 7,500 parts. And then you get up into the what we call concert instruments, and they can have up to 9,000 pieces.
The high-end accordions sell for as much as a new Camaro. Now, that's a lot of money for something that might seem kind of out of date. But Joe Jr. says accordions are back, big time. At the company's headquarters in Linwood, where shelf after shelf display nearly two centuries of accordion history, he explains how his family's story intertwines with that of the squeeze box.
So my grandfather immigrated from Italy back in the turn of the century, came over in this country in 1904, was a professional accordion player, came to the East Coast, started touring with, at that time called the Vaudeville era. So the groups would tour and play these theaters. Well, a lot of places didn't have pianos. So the accordion became extremely popular with all the musicians. That became a primary instrument in vaudeville. He then traveled to the West Coast and basically got the idea that he wanted to know more about the instrument. He wanted to know how they worked and how they were produced. So he went to work for an accordion factory in California, in San Francisco, and spent 5-6 years learning the craft of building accordions. Only place in the country basically that he hadn't been to is the Northwest. So he came up to Seattle just to visit. They fell in love with the location, and 1922 he started building accordions in the basement of his house. Through the 20s and 30s was vaudeville. That was the era for the accordion. So it was kind of known for its, you know, European folk brought over by the old timers. Vaudeville made it a little more popular for mainstream music here in the US. And then we had good enough musicians that started composing works for the accordion, specifically for the accordion, and music of that era. So that kept the accordion going. Then in 1947, 1948, the era between Frank Sinatra and before Elvis, there was a little-known guy, an accordion player by the name of Dick Contino, that was the highest-paying entertainer in the country.
Dick Contino!
Dick Contino made the accordion popular to the masses. So when kids heard him on the radio, they wanted to be a Dick Contino. And that led to people wanting to play the accordion as children, and teachers teaching. Some studios had 4,000 children a month playing the accordion. And there were studios in every major city and every town across the country. It was the largest selling musical instrument in the United States. We didn't see a downturn until the Beatles. It wasn't really the instrument that didn't go out of favor. It was the music that went out of favor. And one of the kind of misnomers is the teachers and all the educators teaching the accordion in the 40s and 50s didn't think about how do we create the accordion for the new style of music. They continued to teach it like they had in the 40s and 50s with the same music, which wasn't popular at the time. And that's really what turned the accordion down. So about the mid-70s, most of all the U.S. accordion manufacturers that were in business went out of business. We stayed small, and we retained our high quality. Fast forward to a decade ago, when my son, fourth generation, came into the business, and we just see a huge new generation of accordion people. So the same thing that made the accordion outdated in the 60s and 70s was the music. This is the same thing that's bringing the accordion back into favor is the change of music, which is the popularity of folk, indie folk, folk rock, all the American genres of music has become popular to the new generation of people. Having your name on your own product, that's something that, I don't know, you feel part of your heart and soul are in every one of these instruments. So it's kind of like this feeling of part of you is going out with every instrument and is going to be part of somebody's life. And so the idea that you want it to be as absolutely perfect as possible is very important to us. I have always loved the business. I've always been proud to be part of something that is kind of I would say history of the United States and the accordion industry. There's no other instrument in the world like an accordion, musically, hands down.
Joe Petosa Jr. is the third generation to run Petosa Accordions, which recently relocated from Seattle to Linwood. To see photos of what an accordion that costs tens of thousands of dollars looks like, go to knkxsoundeffect.org. That's it for our show today. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Bethany Denton. We had help this week from Bellamy Palethorpe, Joanne Buchanan, and Stephen Smith. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can take Sound Effect with you when you subscribe to our twice-weekly podcast. You can get it in all the usual places, Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or your smart speaker. Send us your feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org or find us on Facebook. We're back next week when our theme is Dream On. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.